Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 22, Equity in Education. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. The Freedom Writers and I always say that education can and should equalize an unfair playing field. Today on the podcast, we'll discuss how to ensure that all students have access to an equal education. We'll examine the alarming school-to-prison pipeline and outline what we can do individually and collectively to combat the systemic discrimination of our youth. Whether you're an educator, an administrator, a parent, or a politician, there is more that we can do. First, we'll hear from Freedom Writer teacher Bill Fever, who teaches at the Fresno County Juvenile Justice Campus. Bill seeks to understand incarcerated youth and shares the importance of relationships in guiding them along a path to reach their true potential. Next, we'll have our Diary of the Day segment, a heartfelt letter written by a formerly incarcerated young man, Ronaldo Vieta. Ronnie recounts his discovery of higher education while in the Orange County Juvenile Hall and gives us a glimpse into his goals and dreams now that he's a free man. And finally, our featured guest is renowned educator and activist, Dr. Pedro Noguera. I had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Noguera on the beautiful UCLA campus, where he is currently a distinguished professor of education. We talked about the challenges that educators face in 21st century classrooms, and Dr. Noguera offers invaluable insight into creating more equitable education for all. As you listen, I encourage you to think about the role education plays in shaping your own life. What can we do as a society to provide equal opportunities to equal education for all students, no matter their race, their gender, or their socioeconomic background? Now, here's our Freedom Writer teacher, Bill Fever.
My name is Bill Fever, and I'm a teacher at Worsley School, which is located in the Fresno County Juvenile Justice Campus. We're doing a lot of training in trying to reach out and you know, find out why that kid is got anger issues and how do we deal with those issues and all those types of things. We've been to a lot of seminars over the last 2 or 3 years focusing on that type of thing. I had this thing on Twitter. I follow this teacher whose name is Kelly Gallagher, and it was on his Twitter feed, 10 things you want your teacher to know about you. To present it, he wrote 10 things he wanted his students to know about him. And so I did that for my first lesson for the year. They wanted me to know some really serious things about them, and they shared those with me. And so that gave me a whole different outlook on how I looked at that kid, you know, the kid that is angry and all those kinds of things. And he shares with me, and now you know why he's that way. And when he comes into class, you want to tell him how much you care about him. And it changes my perspective to be better at what I do. You know, the psychologists say that if you come from a situation where you're in a violent situation all the time, the first thing that you're concerned about is protection. So you're always on the high alert, you know, like being in combat all the time. And that's what a lot of our kids are. And so if you know that as a teacher, you can deal with that and give them strategies to help them feel safe. And at the same time, then start to focus on their education and be able to deal with that and start to learn. One of the kids that really opened up to me with my 10 things, he was in our drug program. I mean, he come into class and just get in fights, be angry, do all kinds of things. And he's back. Sometimes they do something that causes them to come back. And he comes in and he's changed a little bit. And he's saying, hey, I hurt people that cared about me, and I didn't realize in the past how much they really cared about me. And I want to say I'm sorry for what I did to them so that I can be a model for my friends and for my brothers and sisters in my life and help them. And that's what we're learning too in these things about kids when they're abused and stuff. They don't know how to have relationships. And when they see people that are kind to them, that they can talk to and they don't have to be afraid, they'll open up. I think a lot of it is these kids don't have moms and dads anymore. I think that's critical. When you don't have mothers and fathers that really care, what are we supposed to do in the schools? We can't be everything. It's really difficult. I think it goes back to start with the relationships. Kids respond to that. They know when you care about them, and they also know when you blow them off. So the thing that I always want to be is to be kind, to be caring, and compassionate. When you go to our graduations, it's totally different because we have a lot of dignitaries from probation, the courts sometimes, and there's maybe 10 kids or 5 kids or 4 kids graduating, and they all get up and they all tell you that they didn't think they could make it that far. And you feel like these kids really struggled to get here, but they made it to graduation from high school. I don't believe in the old facility that I saw one of my students graduate from high school. And in the last 10 years, a bunch have graduated from high school. And so for them to get to that point is wonderful. You know, when it comes down to it, the bottom line is if I make a relationship with them and we can talk about things, I think that is the first step. It's crucial.
Like Bill, I hope we all strive to know our students in such a way that changes our perspective about them, about their struggles, and about our role as educators in helping them become their best selves. Especially to those who are considered at risk, may we be kind and compassionate, and most importantly, provide them with opportunities to trust and to learn. Bill was the very first educator I selected to become a Freedom Rider teacher. His service and accolades in the years since have set the bar high for the 700 Freedom Rider teachers that are following in his footsteps. It's time for our Diary of the Day, a touching reading of a letter written by my new friend, Ronnie Vieta. I first met Ronnie as he neared the end of a 4-year sentence in the Orange County Juvenile Hall. After my visit, Ronnie reflected deeply on his life experiences and affirmed his new commitment to invest in his own education. His story speaks powerfully to the potential we all have to change. It also serves as a call to action for us to reach these young people and be reached by them before they get caught in the system. It is my privilege to introduce you to Ronnie.
Dear Ms. Gruel, I am currently wrapping up a 4-year sentence here at Juvenile Hall. I am 20 years of age, and this is my first time being incarcerated. A large portion of my time here has been spent focusing on school, bettering myself, and writing. As my release date approaches, I constantly ask myself, how can I help change the system so others in my shoes do not become entrapped in it? My story is complicated, just like everybody else's, but it is the one thing which has made me resilient. I found myself in a place where many become lost. I grew from a boy into a young man and have realized my purpose in life. I discovered higher education, which has practically saved my life. I met the most amazing people, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. I am on the cusp of change right now. I am about to be released back into the world, and there's so much I want to do. My main focus is to advocate for my peers, those who I leave behind and those who will come after me. What you did in that English class years ago is something I wish I would have encountered. It could have steered me in the right direction before it was too late. We need more people in the community like you, who are crazy enough and compassionate enough to make a difference. All the best, Ronnie.
I'm so inspired by this amazing young man who has indeed realized his purpose in life. He has an unshakable desire to change the system he unfortunately knows so well. Ronnie is now free and will soon complete the associate's degree he started while in juvenile hall. Next year, he'll pursue a bachelor's degree and continue on the path of becoming an advocate for his peers. I feel certain that we will all be better off because this young man discovered the power of education and is now using it to effect positive change in his community. That's why the Freedomizers and I believe that we must support our youth no matter what struggle they face. Every Christmas Eve, we visit a juvenile hall to deliver a copy of the Freedomizers Diary to each and every inmate. For some, it's the first book they've ever owned. As it was for Ronnie, the Freedomizers story is a beacon of light in what could otherwise be a very dark place. If you would like to support our tradition of giving the Freedomizers Diary to young people in juvenile hall this holiday season, please follow the link in our show notes to donate. I'm excited to introduce our featured guest today, an esteemed figure in the field of education. After serving as a public school teacher for many years, Pedro Noguera obtained his doctorate degree in education from the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Noguera then served as a professor of education at Berkeley, Harvard, and NYU before taking his current position at UCLA. Dr. Noguera has written numerous books about equity in education and is frequently called upon to speak on the state of education in our public schools. He is particularly interested in addressing the issues of the racial achievement gap and the school-to-prison pipeline. Dr. Noguera dedicates his time and talent to finding actionable solutions to better empower all students to succeed. Here's my conversation with Dr. Pedro Noguera. It is such an honor to be here with you, Dr. Noguera, and I would love for you to dive right in and talk about your life's work and your passion.
Thanks, Erin, for this chance to speak with you on this podcast and share some of my work and some of my ideas about education. So I know that education can be transformative in the lives of people. I know that often it's not. That too often what we hear from kids is that they're bored, that they're alienated, that school's not meeting their needs. And I think it's a shame. It's such a lost opportunity. We know that education can be powerful as a source of transformation, that education is the best way to reduce poverty, particularly when you educate women. And the World Bank has shown this for many years, that education is the best way to address crime. Because when you educate a person, particularly an incarcerated person, they're less likely to go back to crime, less likely to go back to prison. We know that education, when we invest in communities, particularly communities that are struggling, and expand opportunity, can help those communities. So we should be doing more as a society to ensure that we're educating all kids and investing in the communities right now where, sadly, we haven't been investing. We are much more likely to focus on prisons and policing than on education, even though prisons and policing cost far more than educating children. Maybe a good segue is for me to share a letter that I received not long ago from a young man in Sing Sing. Sing Sing is a large prison in New York, just outside New York City, in Westchester County. He says, "Dear Mr. Pedro Noguera, not in my wildest dreams would I've ever thought of finding myself and my quest for meaning after reading The Trouble with Black Boys and Other Reflections on Race, Equity, and the Future of Public Education. I can honestly say, upon my arrival at DOCCS, which is the correction facility, in 2001, I was all but physically deceased. A member of a constituency guilty of wandering around aimlessly behind these concrete walls, cawing and blaming everyone else for my shortcomings. A mental corpse waiting idly for that eureka moment to stir something inside of me while confined to my mental tomb. Idleness left to its own devices leaves young and old men and women trapped in an unproductive state of mind. Truth be told, I was doing what I wanted to do instead of what I needed to be doing. I usually don't read the introduction of any book, but your introduction spoke directly to me in a deafening voice. And he quotes, he says, "The fact remains that through education, we have the potential and power to open minds, tap the imagination, cultivate skills, and inspire the innate ability in all human beings to dream and create. Your book challenged me to do better. Your book woke me from an eternal slumber and forced me to take a look at myself and reassess what was actually important to me. I am a Mercy College graduate. I have a TED Talk from 2014 currently on YouTube. I enable men to recognize the need for transformative rehabilitative thought processes. Upon my release in 2020, freedom will no longer be just a dream, but a tangible reality. Thank you."
When you hear this idea of a school-to-prison pipeline, can you explain that to our listeners, whether they're a student or a teacher? What have you found of this conveyor belt of traditionally young men of color going from a segregated school in a low-income area and being processed into juvenile halls, jails, and then prisons?
Sure. So the term school-to-prison pipeline is really a metaphor. Here's what we know. In America, we're most likely to incarcerate those we fail to educate. When you go into prisons and you look at who's behind bars, you find large numbers of people who are illiterate, large numbers of students with special needs whose needs were never met, large numbers of people who were pushed out of school. And usually, the trouble started in school, right? It started with kids who were turned off to learning or who received very punitive treatment in school. Pushed out of school through suspensions, so they end up on the streets, unsupervised. And the fact is that if we address those problems early, we wouldn't end up seeing people incarcerated later, which again is much more costly. So I want to be clear, it's not as though the problems aren't real. They are real. There are kids out there who are angry. There are kids out there who are difficult to work with. There are kids who are disruptive and defiant. And that makes teaching and learning impossible. If you've got a room with kids who are acting out. Here's the problem. When there are behavior problems, we only focus on the behavior. We don't focus on the cause of the behavior problem. If you stop and focus on the cause, then you realize some of the kids who are acting out are neglected. Some of the kids are acting out because they're embarrassed, because they can't read and write, or because they have a strained relationship with the teacher, or because they're bullied. If you don't address the cause of the behavior problem, the problem doesn't go away. In fact, it might get worse. So I would say our schools disproportionately punish the kids with the greatest needs, and too often they punish them because of their needs, because they haven't spent time figuring out how do I address the need that's driving the behavior problem rather than simply focusing on the behavior. So we got to get smarter at that.
And I think that the Freedom Hour story, the essence of that is they all had behavioral issues to begin with because of everything you said. They were foster kids. They were homeless. They had great loss economically and physically. And so I think our story is so sensitive to that. We really looked at what's behind that essay, what's behind that grade, and what's your story. So as a professor and researcher, what do you tell educators about that story or that causality?
What I tell them is that it is so much more effective to address the problem early. I'll give you a story to illustrate that point. I was given a tour of a school by an assistant principal. And he was showing me off. All the renovations have been done, their new computer lab, their new library, the artwork. Very proud. And then we get to his office, and there's a little boy waiting for him. The boy's about 7 years old, and he's in trouble. And he turns to me and he says, "You see that boy?" He said, "There's a prison cell in San Quentin waiting for that boy now." I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, that boy's constantly causing trouble. He's a hellraiser. He acts out, and he's got a father in prison, a brother in prison, and I can tell by the way he behaves now that one day he too will be in prison."
And he was 7 years old.
7 years old. So I turn and ask him, I say, "Well, given what you know about this boy, what are you doing to keep him out of prison?" And he looks at me surprised and puzzled, because he doesn't think that's his job. What he thinks his job is to punish him. And what he was about to do was to suspend him for 30 days, where he would send the work home to his sick grandmother and effectively washed his hands of the boy. Now, I have no doubt that that boy is probably difficult to deal with, that he probably is a challenge for teachers. But if we don't respond to those behaviors now and address the cause, it's gonna get worse. Our schools sometimes are literally producing delinquents through their neglect of these issues. And that, to me, is how schools become complicit in this school-to-prison pipeline. And sadly, then the educators are often complicit too. But rather than blaming the educators, I think what we have to understand is why do the institutions work the way they do to produce these outcomes? Schools are too often fixated on control. If you're a child who is obedient, who is compliant, you can do well. If you're a child who's fidgety, if you're a child who asks a lot of questions, if you're a child who doesn't trust adults because of your history, you're probably gonna have trouble in school. Not because of your intellectual ability, but because of your social skills. And our schools aren't very good at teaching social skills. We fixate too much on sitting still rather than actively engaging kids in learning. And so there's a lot that needs to change if we're gonna change outcomes for kids.
Talk about equity and what that means for our listeners. What is equity in a school situation in our schools?
Equity in the context of education is taken off, right? And lots of people are interested, a lot of people are writing about it, myself included, been doing it for a while now. And why it's important is because we know that when we treat everyone the same, when we practice some version of what we think equality is, we end up not treating everyone well because our kids aren't all the same. Some kids need more time and attention than others. Some kids don't have anyone to help them at home with homework. Some kids are coming to school hungry or with other needs that need to be addressed. And so when we have an equity lens, it forces us to see the child and all their needs and understand that the social needs are connected to the educational needs, to the physical needs, the emotional needs, and we have to figure out, and this is where it gets hard, how do you respond to those needs? If you don't respond to the needs, then the kids with the greatest needs will always be the kids most likely to fail. And that's what we see in most schools.
What I love about you as an activist is your belief in the democracy of public schools. Can you talk about that, about how important it is for a democracy to have good public schools?
Yeah. I want to say first that our public schools are the most accessible institutions in the country. All kids, regardless of their backgrounds, including the undocumented, including children whose parents are incarcerated, homeless children, they all have a right to an education. In fact, the law requires it. They don't have a right to an equal education. And so we are one of few countries that deliberately spends more money to educate wealthy children than we do to educate poor children. And that's both within the public schools, but it's even greater, the inequities, when we compare public to private schools in most cases. And so if we're really serious as a country about using education to break the cycle of poverty, to promote opportunity, then what we've got to do is to get much better at investing in education, to provide children with resources early. So preschool, so critical, because we know that the learning starts young, and that when you invest in preschool, it benefits a person throughout their life. After school programs, because we know there are a lot of parents who are working and their kids are unsupervised after school. How much wiser to invest in quality after school programs that middle class people usually have for their kids, whose kids are in soccer and gymnastics? Well, poor kids need that too. So when we have an equity lens, we think about the whole child, we think about the needs of a community, and we make investments accordingly.
For someone of your stature who has educated in both private and public universities, what was it like for you to walk the halls as a student first and then to walk the halls as a professor later?
Well, good question. So I was a student at Brown University, and that's, you know, a prominent Ivy League school. One of the students in my class was John F. Kennedy Jr., right? You got to know him, right? So I'm going to school with the former president's son. Very intimidating because I come from Brooklyn. I come from Brownsville, and neither of my parents graduated from high school. So I felt like an imposter who didn't fit in. But after just a few months of being on campus, I realized I had some things that they didn't have. I, for example, knew how to work hard because from the time I was 12, I had a job because I came from a family where I had to contribute. I had street smarts, and I knew that you needed allies and mentors, and so I got a mentor early. So although I felt initially intimidated about being this Ivy League school, I quickly figured out I had assets that could help me and that enabled me to be successful there. When I went off to teach at Harvard and then again at Berkeley and NYU and now at UCLA, what I consistently find is those schools are really good at attracting top students even from poor families like me and getting them in. And often, a lot of times, those students end up with obstacles, despite their academic abilities, that get in the way. I had a student in that seat you're in right now yesterday who's a full-time student at UCLA and working two jobs at the same time. And he's working two jobs because he's sending money home to his family because his father just got laid off and his mother cleans houses. And he feels guilt about being a student here while his family's going through such suffering. But he also knows that getting his degree will enable him to help his family even more. So he's trying to find the balance. How do I get my education and help my family? And I'm trying to figure out with him how to do that. Those are the issues our students are contending with. He shouldn't have to worry about that. He should have scholarships to go to UCLA. You know, if he were in Canada, he wouldn't have to worry about the cost of his education because public universities are very cheap in Canada. But that's not the case here. So I see students often who are dealing with huge barriers despite their strong intellectual ability.
For our young listeners who may not know about the Supreme Court case, can you describe what Brown versus Board of Education was hoping for and actually the reality all these years later?
So Brown is obviously historically very significant. A unanimous court decision, and not there aren't many, which basically ended apartheid in America, right? Because although the ruling was for schools and saying that we could no longer segregate kids on the basis of race, that set precedent for eliminating racial segregation in housing, in voting rights, in employment. It broke down the racial barriers across our society. And that's why I often say our schools, public schools, usually are the most democratic institutions, because we make changes in schools, whether it be on race or gender or ability or language, and that permeates our society eventually. The problem is our schools are still segregated by race and class, because the courts never really took on how we would go about integrating. And since Brown, we've had many rulings that have limited its impact, right? That have said, for example, we're not going to involve the suburbs. So we know our cities are already segregated. If you don't involve the suburbs, then you're not going to have anybody to integrate with. And so we have kids now today that are segregated on the basis of race and class in almost every major city throughout the United States. And sometimes even in the suburbs, because our communities are so segregated. And we know it's a problem. It's a problem because the money follows wealthy white kids, period. We consistently spend more money to educate wealthy white kids than poor black and Latino kids. And anybody who doesn't believe that isn't paying attention.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. When the Freedom Riders book originally came out, we started traveling and going to public schools across America. We've now been to all 50 states, and most of those states we've been able to go to rural areas, suburban areas, and inner city areas of every major city in America. And it was the Freedom Riders who were traveling with me who would always notice that why are schools so segregated? And they use the word educational apartheid. Do you believe that there still is educational apartheid in 2018?
Absolutely. I mean, just look at the conditions. I mean, I was just at a school in Watts this morning. If you compare that to the schools in Santa Monica, schools in Beverly Hills, it's night and day. You know, just the quality of the facilities. But it's not just the facilities. It's now, do you offer lab science? Do you offer advanced placement courses? Do you have certified teachers? We don't address those issues. And so, although we provide equal access to schooling, we don't provide access to equal schooling and equal opportunity. And that, it makes it less likely that you're going to see kids who come out of Watts who are able to get a place like UCLA, right? Because we haven't even provided the opportunity to learn from many of those kids.
So, as an educator, you're also very political. How do you make education a political issue?
Sometimes you got to go directly to the politicians. I'll be speaking to the members of the state legislature in New Mexico next week, because they're trying to move from being one of the last in educational performance in the country and move forward. What they have to realize is they haven't invested in their children. They've invested in other things, but not in children, not in schools. But you could say the same thing has been true about California and many other states. California is starting to make progress, but California is home to Google. It's home to Apple, home to Hollywood and agribusiness. And we were at one point one of the last in per pupil spending. And that's not because we don't have the money. It's because we are cheap when it comes to children. We haven't invested in children. I can take you to classrooms right here in Los Angeles where there are 38 students in the class with a teacher. Those are not the conditions that are conducive to good teaching and learning. So there's a lot we have not done. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen strikes in several states by teachers in Oklahoma, West Virginia, Arizona. And it's because teachers now are feeling all of the burden, they can barely make ends meet, and they are seeing the effects of poverty directly. And so I think the public is starting to realize that when we don't invest in children, when we don't invest in teachers, our whole society is affected. Earlier on in my career, I would often get people who would feel defensive by what I was saying, especially teachers, because, you know, I always try to think about what does the audience need to hear from me? And if I'm speaking to teachers, I usually challenge them about, you know, where's the evidence that the kids are learning in your classrooms? But now I find I get that reaction much less. And it's because I'm much more intentional about talking about what people need to do. So instead of just laying on the problem in their lap, say, no, this is what we can do, and making it real clear that there's a lot we can do now to solve the problem. We don't have to wait till we elect a new government or until we get the right policies in place. No, there are schools right now that are serving kids well that we're not learning from, and we need to learn from them. We need to understand what they're doing to make a difference.
Why do politicians not invest in education?
The evidence is first important. So Robert Putnam, a famous political scientist at Harvard, wrote a book called Our Kids. And he starts by describing his hometown. He goes back to Clinton, Ohio, where he grew up. Small town on Lake Erie that when he graduated in 1964, sent 80% of the kids to college. And these were working class kids, right? Mixed race, because it was even integrated then. And he goes back 60 years later, school's in shambles, racially segregated, and most kids are dropping out, not functioning. And he asks, what happened? How come it was once able to serve kids and it can't do it now? Same thing at DeWitt Clinton High School. James Baldwin graduated from there. Burt Lancaster, all kinds of generals, judges graduated from there. Had over 6,000 kids at one point in the 1970s, and it was integrated. Today, less than 2,000 kids. More homeless kids than any school in New York City. More formerly incarcerated youth. Nobody chooses it as a first choice school. Why? Because it doesn't offer anything. It doesn't offer courses that will help you to get to college. It doesn't have resources. So there's been this systematic disinvestment of schools in poor communities especially. Not only don't we see the courses, we don't see gyms, we don't see swimming pools, we don't see
classes and music classes.
Exactly. And so, you know, we ask, why are people leaving public schools for charter schools? In many cases, well, what are the public schools offering? And why aren't the resources there to make it possible? So this is a huge political problem that we have to address as a nation, because when we shortchange our schools, we shortchange our kids, we shortchange our future.
It's still a civil rights issue that's
absolutely
that's playing out before our eyes.
But, you know, when I hear that term, civil rights issue, I have to be careful, because there are a lot of politicians who like to say education is a civil rights issue of the 21st century. You know, I heard Arne Duncan say that a lot when he was Secretary of Education, for example, but they never explained what that meant. It is a civil rights issue. But if it's a civil rights issue, then what we need to recognize is that the opportunity to learn and extending that opportunity, that's the civil rights issue. And why aren't we ensuring that that's what we're doing? Blaming teachers is not a strategy for improving schools. Threatening schools and telling them you're going to shut them down is not the solution, because schools don't get better through pressure. They get better when you build the capacity of those schools. And so we have pursued many failed strategies that have left us where we are. And I blame both Democrats and Republicans, because neither party has been very good on education.
Do you find that you're also in the business of, when there's a crisis, people go to you and ask for advice? I've seen you in every venue, on a stage, in universities, but also on television. Whenever there's been an issue of inequity, you are the person speaking on behalf of the underdog. Is that a huge burden or a blessing for you?
I regard it as a blessing to be able to be a resource to hopefully help shed some light. Even after the mass shootings that have occurred, like the one that occurred in Parkland, I've written about school violence and I've written about the conditions that promote safety. And so I've been called upon to speak on it. And what I try to remind people, safety is not a byproduct of security. You know, right now we have this call to arm teachers, which I think is absurd. I'd say the fact is, when you go to schools that are truly safe, they're not safe because they have metal detectors and armed guards. They're safe because kids are known. They're safe because teachers work together and collaborate. They're safe because parents are involved. That's what makes schools safe. It's the relationships, not the security system. And you look at the school shootings that have taken place, I would say that the one in Newtown is an exception, because that individual was a mentally ill person who came to the school. And that's another crisis of mental illness in our society. But you look at this one in Parkland, and you saw Columbine and many others, the signs of trouble were there, that these kids had difficulty. Other kids knew that this person was having difficulty, and they were not addressed. And so, you know, that's the thing. If you work on improving relationships with kids, if you invest in counselors and social workers instead of security guards, then you have people around who can actually be a resource for kids. So that a child in trouble, a child in crisis, like the kid who shot up the school in Parkland, who had lost his mother, who was himself in some ways at risk, what would have happened if he'd gotten help earlier? Who knows? Maybe he would not have shot up the school. Or at least if someone was seeing him, they would have known, this kid is at risk and we need an even more serious intervention than I can provide right now. But we've got to be better at doing that. If we go down the path of simply saying we're going to arm our teachers, we're going to create schools that are like prisons, I think that's the wrong direction. I try to remind people, prisons are not safe places. And they are the ultimate secure facilities. So if prisons aren't safe places, why would we use that as the model that we're emulating for our schools?
Going back to that beautiful letter you received, can you talk about seeing people for who they are and where they're at, rather than what they did, rather than the label that put them behind bars?
I try to model that throughout my life, and I have seen, especially in schools, that when you treat everyone with dignity, from the custodian to the receptionist to every child to the teachers and administrators, it brings the best out of people. Schools need to be caring communities. They need to be places where our humanity is affirmed, where we treat people with dignity and respect. And in my life, I've seen over and over again that that makes a huge difference. So whatever role you're in, right, whether it be teacher, principal, bus driver, parent, community member who's just concerned, everyone could do something to make a difference. And that's what we have to ask ourselves, all right? If I'm a teacher, how do I make sure that my students are challenged? How do I tap into their natural curiosity so they want to learn, right? How do I make my classroom a place where kids feel safe? If you're an administrator, how do I support my teachers, right? How do I make sure my teachers feel inspired? I've never seen a high-performing school where teachers have low morale and where teachers feel abused and beaten down. So what am I going to do to recognize and to honor my teachers? If I'm a parent, what am I going to do to make sure my kids get enough rest at night and to make sure that they feel supported and understand that education is important, that I listen to them? Because a lot of times parents aren't good listeners. They simply think they can tell kids what to do, and that usually doesn't work. So I think regardless of what role we play, there's a role to play in supporting education. Even if you don't have kids at all, simply to say, look, public education is important. We need to support our schools. We need to make sure they have resources. And we need to hold them accountable to make sure they do their job. That's a very important public role that we should play. I think there are lots of different ways in which all of us could be involved in supporting education.
For students, say, let's picture that beautiful 7-year-old boy sitting outside the principal's office. What do you say to that 7-year-old boy to reframe what the principal said? If the principal said there's a cell at San Quentin, when you walk up, what do you say to that boy?
So I would probably not say much, because I don't believe that you could change behavior through a lecture, right? I would work on building a relationship with him. I'd want him to know me. I'd want him to feel safe with me. I'd want him to see me as a person that he could trust. Because if I build that relationship, then I could also probably convince him to be a better student than he is right now, to be a member of that community. My earliest teaching experience was working with 5-year-olds who had supposedly had behavior problems. And I was a college student at Brown, and I would go up to the school and I would work with these 5-year-olds. And the teacher I was assigned to work with said, when you come, you can do whatever you want with these boys. They give so much trouble, they're yours. 5 little boys, little black boys, who she said were trouble. So since she said I could do whatever I want with them, second time I came, I brought a football. And I just played football with them because I figured they like football, I'm going to play football with them, and I'm going to work out some of that energy, get them tired. And it worked because as I did something they enjoyed, I could build a relationship, I could start to learn about who they were, they could learn about who I was. Within a couple weeks, they would do anything with me, and they still wouldn't work for their teacher who had never built that kind of relationship with them. And I realized not everybody can play football with kids, but it doesn't take football. You can do it in so many ways. By showing interest in a person, you can start to build a relationship with them. And what we have to always remember is that children learn through relationships. And they know if you don't like them. They know if you don't care about them, if you're afraid of them. They know it. And it works as a wall that separates the relationship. I think there's an assumption that status and authority will give you more credibility. And for a lot of kids, that's not where credibility comes from. The credibility is who you are. Do you walk the walk, talk the talk? Do you really care about who I am? That's where credibility comes from. I call it moral authority. Do you have moral authority? Moral authority is not about your title or your position. It's about your relationship. There's still authority there. As adults, you do have responsibility. The children, you're not equals, right? And an adult has the responsibility of providing guidance, has the responsibility of letting the child know, that's dangerous, don't do that. Giving them feedback. You should never relinquish that. But at the same time, it's not about overbearing and trying to force kids into things. It's about guiding, mentoring, leading, demonstrating what they need to do. Those are the ways in which children learn best and are more likely to follow.
With that moral credibility and the idea of street credibility, what would you recommend to teachers who have to deal with students who have like a code of the streets? Like for me, I had a student who witnessed a murder and was planning to testify in court against somebody because they didn't look like her or talk like her, because you don't rat, you don't snitch, you don't turn on a homeboy. And educationally, I had to figure out how do I create that relationship to allow her to see that there are other ways. So how do you encourage educators to use that moral authority, knowing they're going into situations where the code of the street may be different than the code of the classroom?
Again, it goes back to relationships and establishing and building trust with our students. And as we build trust, we'll learn things about them. Now, some of the things that we learn might disturb us, right? We might learn about the hardships in their life. We might learn about the dangers they face or the illegal activities they're involved in. But if we have credibility and trust, then they'll see us as a person they can turn to. I remember several years ago, I was working with a continuation high school, and a student I'd been working with for several years came to me and the principal one day and told us that he and his brother had been shot at, his brother had been wounded, and he had to retaliate. He said, the reason why I have to retaliate is because if I don't retaliate, I won't be able to show my face on the street anymore. And he took us and he showed us he had guns in the back of his car, right? So he was serious. But we figured if he was showing us the guns and telling us, it was probably because he wanted to be convinced and shown there could be another way. And we spent several hours with this young man talking about what are the consequences of retaliating, why he didn't want to do that. He was a young father himself and what that might mean. And after several hours of talking to him and convincing him not to retaliate, and then the next question was, if he doesn't retaliate, how do we get him out of there? Because he will be at risk if he doesn't retaliate. He could literally be killed. And so this was at the time of the first Iraq war, and we had to help him enlist. Now think about the irony. He was going to be more safe at war overseas than in his own community in Richmond, California. That was a sad reflection on the state of America. But for him at that time, that was the best choice available. Now the story is good because he came back and he was able to get a good job, a good civil service job. He's a good father and he's a role model in his community. But things could have turned out very differently had we not been able to intervene then and provide some alternatives. And that's where this work is hard. We have to face the fact that many kids are faced with difficult circumstances. They need help and there are no simple solutions to some of the problems they face. But if we were investing in schools, if schools were genuinely assets of their communities, where families could turn to for hope, and I should tell you, I spoke to principals throughout Vermont this past summer. The number one issue they wanted to talk about was the opioid crisis and the impact it's having on children they serve. One principal told me in a month, 53 of his students were placed in foster care because their parents had been arrested or were strung out. 53 kids.
Wow.
This is in rural schools where 53 kids might be half the school. And these are all white kids, right? Because Vermont is a white state, pretty much. So what we should know is that there are a lot of people out there hurting. And schools are our best resource for addressing and responding, but schools can't do it alone, right? The principal of that school that lost those kids, he said, why didn't they warn me that many of my kids were going to end up in foster care? Why didn't they send me a social worker so they could do some outreach to these families? I can't do it by myself, is what he was saying. And sadly, that's what we've done. We've expected teachers to be social workers and psychologists, to be a surrogate parent and teach, and they can't do it. We need to provide more support to schools than we are right now and stop setting schools up to fail and teachers up to be overwhelmed.
I want to end with a compliment. The Freedom Riders took the name Freedom Riders in honor of the proud Freedom Riders from the 60s. And look at someone like John Lewis as a true hero. And I think you are the John Lewis of education.
Oh, thank you. I mean that sincerely.
John Lewis said he got arrested over 40 times for getting into trouble. He calls it good trouble. I believe you like to get into good trouble. So how does an educator or a parent or a student get into good trouble and fight a good fight?
Yeah. I think we get into trouble when we speak up for the disadvantaged. We get into trouble when we challenge the status quo. We get into trouble when we say what needs to be said and no one else is saying it. Right? I'll give you an example. I was talking to a group of principals in a very wealthy district in New Jersey. Wealthy district that should be a place where they educate all kids, except the small number of children of color they had were not well served. So they wanted me to come and talk about the achievement gap, what they should do. And I explained to them, I said that a lot of this gap in achievement is perpetuated by some kids being denied the opportunity to learn. And you have to stop that. So they looked at me and the principal raised his hand and he said, I have an example of what you described. I said, well, share it with the group. He said, well, I'm new here and I was the principal at the high school. And I noticed that when the bell rings, there's often a group of boys, black boys, who are in the halls and aren't in class. And it seems like everyone's okay with it. And I decided I was going to put a stop to it. So I told them they had to go to class, and I was going to escort them to class. And as I did, I found out they were all going to class in the basement of the school. And I didn't know we even had classes in the basement. And when I got down there with them, I learned that's where the special ed classes were being held. And I also learned there was no learning going on. And the kids told me there was a waste of time being there, and they didn't like being in the basement because everybody knows that's where the dumb kids go. So in front of the whole groups, he says, I think it's time to take these kids out of the basement. And the other people turned away, embarrassed, looked away, because they'd been in the basement for years. Mm. Now, I don't think you need to be a rocket scientist to know that when you stigmatize kids in that way, you really are pretty much sealing their fate. Yeah. You are putting them on that school-to-prison pipeline. And a lot of times, there are well-meaning adults who see kids being denied learning opportunities and do nothing. That's what has to change. They need to speak up and say, you know what? This setup is not going to work. Education is one of the few fields where we will deliberately assign the least experienced teachers, the least effective teachers to work with the neediest kids. We don't do that to doctors. We don't do that to pilots. We do that to teachers. We set them up to fail. So there is a lot that promotes inequity. We need to counter that by calling it out so that we can do a better job than we do now.
In honor of their truth, may we all work toward equity in education. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Cyrier and our associate producer, Clay Amontorp, with production assistance and additional editing by Rob Falk. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we treat everyone with dignity. May we lead with moral authority. And as our guest, Dr. Nagara, encourages, may we create caring communities where everyone's humanity is affirmed. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.